This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We rely on our court system to mete out justice. It is a flawed system administered by imperfect people, but for most of us, it represents our best hope for a fair resolution to complicated problems. Judge Craig Brown spent his three-decade career working in the judicial system. He was first a criminal defense attorney, then later a district court judge in Durham. His decisions and his comments from the bench were often controversial. Judge Brown also volunteered beyond the confines of the justice system to battle social problems that the courts are not always prepared to address. All the while, he waged a battle against blindness, one that he lost in his mid-30s. He has written two books about his experiences, Blind Justice and A Fork in the Road, and he's my guest today on The State of Things. Judge Craig Brown, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Good afternoon, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Let's start out with your personal story. You weren't born in Durham, but your family has deep roots here. How did you come to live in the Bull City?
Well, my father worked for the Veterans Administration. As a result of that, we moved around the country quite a bit, nine times during my first 13 years. We came actually through Durham twice, once in the late 60s, and my father was director of the VA hospital here from 1980 to 1985. And then CEO of Duke Hospital thereafter.
You did most of your growing up in Iowa City.
I did. It was really the first place where we had time to settle down. Dad was at the VA hospital in Iowa City from 1970 to 1980. It gave me a chance for the first time to put my roots down. And in many respects, I blossomed there, largely as a result of that.
Yes, and you burned some of those roots, quite literally, in the Athens of Iowa.
Well, the 75 that I burned with seven other of my compatriots on the football field at City High School is still there and still visible, which simply proves that what Rome did to Carthage still works today.
It still works. That 75, of course, your graduating year.
That is correct.
And I guess now it has since become a tradition. So what got you in a little bit of hot water with the local cops turns out to be somewhat of a tradition now. Is that true?
Well, it began a tradition. It did get me a little bit of hot water. My father, I learned later, made very sure that I learned the lessons that I express in my second chapter of the book, A Fork in the Road.
And you, the Rome to Carthage connection, of course, is the fact that you all used salt to do that.
About half a ton of rock salt, as a matter of fact. It worked very effectively.
So what were the lessons? What did you learn from that?
Well, simply that I had to be careful, that your reputation was important, that when your future is lying ahead of you, you need to be especially mindful of that. And perhaps my school spirit outweighed my common sense in terms of that endeavor.
You came to UNC then as an undergraduate, and so tell us about that and coming to Carolina.
Well, the launching pad that I had from City High School in Iowa City, Iowa, led me to become, I guess Chapel Hill sort of has, they take about one Iowa freshman per year in their incoming freshman class. I had fallen in love with Chapel Hill when I lived in Durham back during the late 1960s, and for whatever reason, I always wanted to go back. When I came back to Chapel Hill, it was a wonderful experience from an academic, a social, an intellectual, an extracurricular activity paradise, and I flowered there as well.
And that's when you first began to experience the symptoms of Behçet's disease.
Behçet's began my freshman year. It resulted in five academic incompletes that year, five more my sophomore year, and four more during my year of Duke graduate school for a total of 14.
And it took the doctors a while to figure out what was going on, right?
It took them about 3.5 years before the eye symptoms actually began, and that was sort of the bellwether, if you will, in terms of defining the illness that I had.
What did you do when you – was it clear that you were losing your eyesight at first?
At first, no. It was about a year before the eye hemorrhages began. I had a total between 1981 and 1984 of 19 different eye hemorrhages in my left eye, which was quite eerie because if I was awake, I had the opportunity to watch it, to watch the blood vessel burst. It was like a wildfire hose, if you will, spewing blood across the field of my vision, and then watching the blood turn black and oxidize, and then I would lose sight in that eye for a period of weeks or months.
What did you think when you finally got the diagnosis?
It was very depressing. I mean, I didn't know quite what to think. Certainly, it threatened the future that I had planned for myself at that point, which was to be a litigator, a lawyer. In many respects, for many years, I denied the fact that I was ever going to actually go blind. I thought I would be that percentage exception to the rule. But ultimately, my doctors, who told me initially I'd go blind in 2 years, put me on an aggressive treatment of prednisone. I've probably taken several hundred thousand milligrams of prednisone over my life, which slowed the disease process down such that I did not go blind for 16 years instead of two.
Instead of two.
That's correct.
What do we know about Behçet's? What did you know at the time, and what did your doctors know?
It's a very rare autoimmune disease. What it does, you know, first of all, it affects the entire body. It's not just the eyes. The eyes are one of the precursors of it, but it affects the entire system. What it causes is small blood vessels to burst anywhere in the body, and that obviously causes problems depending on where the blood vessels are located.
Mm-hmm. You, despite this chronic illness, though, you did become involved in student government. How did that shape your legal career? Was that something that you saw as a springboard, or was there something that happened in your involvement that got you thinking about the law?
Well, it was sort of my involvement in student government at Chapel Hill built upon my involvement in student government at City High School. So that it was part and parcel of the same. It gave me an opportunity, since I arrived on the campus not knowing a soul, to interact with my classmates quite a bit. Leadership has always been, for one way or another, a forte of mine. My brother tells me that I've been a lawyer and a leader since I was about 12. So it came very naturally to me, and I enjoyed meeting the members of the faculty, the members of the administration. I developed over the years strong mentors that helped me finish school despite the medical problems I was having.
And you work closely with Albert Coates. He's a legendary founder of UNC's Institute of Government. What did you learn from him?
Oh, so much. I mean, you know, I can say he's an icon, certainly in terms of UNC Chapel Hill. He was an amazing gentleman, his mind word. And there were so many stories he told me about North Carolina history, the development of the Institute of Government, life in general. I had the opportunity to work with him for about 5 years on the first written history of student self-governance at Chapel Hill from 1795 to 1980. And that was an absolute pleasure.
Now, it sounds like you're interested in law as the law in public policy, and yet when you graduated from UNC Law School, I understand you thought you'd be a tax attorney.
Well, that's true. Of course, I came out during the middle of the 82-83 recession. There weren't many jobs at that point, much less for a tax lawyer. But what I also did was I got a joint degree, a master's in public policy from Duke University, which really complemented my interest, particularly when I later became a judge.
What drew you to criminal law?
Criminal law simply was the most interesting. I mean, just the defendants, the attorneys, the stories, the reality of trying to protect someone's liberty. We're working with the disadvantaged and coming to understand where they're coming from, and talking to them in a respectful way such that they would understand the risks and consequences if they went a particular route with their case.
You talk about in your book your very first criminal case that turned out very badly.
You're talking about the real name of the case is State versus Cecilia Gugua. That was my first felony appointment. I made the mistake of continuing the case from a judge who probably would have given us a favorable plea to one who would not. In fact, it was her first offense. She was charged with food stamp fraud. She was not a citizen of the United States. And the district attorney was able to portray her as someone who was stealing from the people of North Carolina, even though she had paid back all but $100 of the money she had taken, the presiding judge sentenced her to 6 years active.
And what were your options? What was it that you did wrong in this case, or did you feel like you should have done differently?
At that point, there was no requirement in North Carolina law to advise the defendant of the fact that if they received more than 18 months active, they would be deported.
18 months in prison, a prison sentence, right?
That's correct.
They could be deported. You didn't have to tell her that.
Well, it wasn't required then. It was only required at the federal level. As a result of the appeal, that changed and became North Carolina law, and the plea transcript includes the question now, are you a citizen and resident of the United States?
So what would you have done differently, knowing that? Just advise her not to plead because she's facing this 18-month-plus prison sentence?
Well, what I would have done first is talk to more of the senior attorneys in Durham and do a better job of judge shopping in terms of pleading the case out.
And we'll talk more about that and the consequences of that case and lessons learned as our conversation with retired Judge Craig Brown continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest, retired Judge Craig Brown. He's chronicled his career in the judicial system and his battle with blindness in a pair of books, Blind Justice and A Fork in the Road. And just before the break, we were talking about your first criminal case. It ended kind of badly because you maybe didn't give the right advice to your client, and it ended up getting her in a little more hot water. Tell us about this. There was fallout from this case.
Well, there was. There's no question that I went down in flames for my first felony plea. As a result of her 6-month sentence, she appealed to the North Carolina Court of Appeals. The Prisoners' Rights Project from Raleigh came in and filed a motion for appropriate relief. Sometime later, she was granted relief. A different judge placed her on probation, and as a result of that, she was able to avoid deportation.
And the fallout from this, what were your lessons learned from that case itself? Again, your first felony plea, you're brand new to this.
Well, what it taught me was that I had to pay more attention to who was sitting on the bench, first and foremost. It also taught me that I had to look outside the box in terms of what other rights my client had to make sure that I covered all of them appropriately. It was a very major learning experience from which I learned a great deal.
This judge shopping business that you're talking about is fascinating, I think, and revealing in some ways. And it came home to you when you went to talk with the DA about the schedule that was coming up and the cases that you might take from that point forward, right?
Well, absolutely. He brought it up. I did not. The then district attorney, Ron Stevens, who retired several years ago as a Superior Court judge, was then district attorney. And he told me in no uncertain terms that it would not be fair for me or fair for my clients to appear in front of the Superior Court judge ever again. And he would not schedule me in front of that judge. And he did not do so for the next 7 years.
Now, this is the judge that originally sentenced your client.
That is correct.
And it ended up getting overturned.
That's right.
And now he's like you. You better not appear before this judge anymore.
That's right.
This must be common because you've gotten advice from the district attorney. You're a defense attorney.
That's correct.
So it doesn't feel right to us. I have to say, I will now speak for the people who are not in the courthouse every day, that we would shop for a judge. We all feel that every one of these judges is going to take the case the same way, and it shouldn't matter who I appear before.
Well, any judge brings to the bench their own preferences and biases because they're people. They have their own life experience, their own education, their own background, their own values. Certainly, I think for the vast majority of cases, it's very true that you'll get the same result whether you go in front of this judge or that judge. It is the more what I would call the strange animals that appear, the different types of cases where it becomes very important. If you can, and you can't always do it, Frank, but you try to put your client in front of the judge that will be most receptive to the arguments that a defense lawyer is making. And that's very standard in the practice of law. There's absolutely nothing illegal with it. It's a lawyer doing the best he can for his or her client.
How many years did you spend as a defense attorney?
13.
During that time, you worked out on a number of first-degree murder cases, right? Three capital cases.
Handled 13 murder cases, which, by the way, is nothing compared to Art Ban, who handled 47, bless his heart. But I handled two capital cases as a result.
In that case, your client's life is at stake. What's it like to take a case like that?
It is a whole different level of intensity. Frank, I don't believe in the death penalty. Now, there are special situations like Ted Bundy or Osama bin Laden, people who commit murder to that extent. But generally speaking, in most cases, I do not believe in the death penalty. I simply believe it is morally and ethically wrong for the state to put to death and be at the same level as the murderer who murdered the victim.
Your first capital case was the defense of Elric Vaughters. Tell us about that case.
Well, that was a fascinating case. My co-counsel was Bill Cotter, who had tried two capital cases before. He sat first chair. The biggest problem with the Vaughters case was that our client was a 24-year-old alcoholic with next to no criminal record. He did not remember anything about the case, about the facts of the case. It is very difficult for a lawyer to prepare a defense in a case when your client remembers nothing, because a lawyer simply has, ethically, cannot invent facts to defend a case. That's wrong.
And this was a capital case, so that ultimately, that could become a mitigating circumstance, alcoholism or being intoxicated at the time.
Well, it did turn out to be that way. Ultimately, the Vaughters case taught me that sometimes you had to break all the rules to avoid the death penalty. It was the first time in Durham County that a defendant pled guilty to first-degree capital murder. As a result of his intoxication and alcoholism, the issue of premeditation was dropped by the state. We pled guilty to felony first-degree murder, and the case ultimately went to the jury on that basis. The real turning point, though, came when our client told us in no uncertain terms that he wanted to testify and express his remorse to the family. Now, by that point, of course, we'd broken two rules, pleading guilty to a first-degree capital case and putting a defendant on the stand during the guilt phase. That was a very difficult roll of the dice. When Bill Cotter told me that he had decided to do that, he told me quite simply that we were either the best of lawyers or the worst of lawyers, and we would find out in the next 5 minutes.
Now, when you plead guilty to a first-degree capital case, of course, now you're liable for the death penalty. But when the prosecution dropped premeditation, does that automatically remove that standard required for execution? Did you know at that point that that's off the table?
No.
So that might happen. And saying I did it and I'm sorry may or may not help. But in fact, you've got the client now who is... who could now stand for cross-examination and have to be questioned by the prosecution on the stand in a capital case?
We did not know at the time he took the stand precisely what he would say. We had some idea. We hoped it would come across in a fair manner. Excuse me. But when he took the stand, he admitted his guilt. He apologized to the jury. He apologized to the judge. He apologized to the family. It was not a Matlock episode. It was meant from the heart. And then he broke down on the witness stand.
What do you think it was in that case that allowed your client to avoid execution?
Him taking responsibility. So often in a criminal case, the defendant does not take responsibility until they see that there is no other alternative. In this case, it was not only that. I think it was his character that also compelled him to take the remarkable to give the remarkable testimony that he did. When the district attorney cross-examined him, he only had three questions. Are you guilty of first-degree murder? Yes. Are you guilty of armed robbery? Yes. Are you guilty of larceny of a motor vehicle? Yes. And that was the end of his cross-examination.
Your second capital case, Richard Nelms, and that was especially difficult to defend his life because he attempted to escape from jail. Tell us about that case.
You know, that case was a convenience store armed robbery and murder. We felt very confident after the conclusion of the state's case and before the beginning of ours that we had a life case at that point. What we didn't count on is that over the weekend, between the verdict on Friday and the beginning of the sentencing phase on Monday, that our client would attempt to escape from the Durham County Jail. Now, what that meant is that we had to flush about 30 of our mitigating factors, because obviously if we put his character in evidence, the state had every right to put the escape in their evidence. And we were confident that if that came in, he was a dead man.
Yeah, maybe without getting too technical, how does that work? How does that equivalence or matching work? If I say this about him, you can say that, but if I don't, you can't. How do you match those lists?
Well, if you think about it, it's logical in the sense that if we give up so much of our mitigating evidence, the state per Mr. Nifong at that point, he was the attorney for the state, agreed not to bring in evidence of the escape.
Oh, I see. So that's a deal you make before you go in.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And tell us how that one turned out.
Well, the case, we probably put on the weakest sentencing phase you've ever seen, in the sense that basically we had two mitigating factors. Our client was crazy, and he had a bad life. Now, that would account for probably about half the jury at some stage or another, at least the bad life part. When we interviewed an alternate juror after they went into deliberation and explained to her why we had taken that approach in light of his attempt to escape, she completely understood. Even so, as it was, the jury came back. When the jury walks into a courtroom, as they've indicated they're going to give their verdict, the first thing a lawyer does is to see if the jury is looking at them or looking at their client, because that implies there is some level of hope or mercy. When the jury came into the courtroom that morning, no one looked at us. And I sat there and I knew what that meant, maybe. And I was prepared to take the big hit. But then the jury foreman announced that the jury verdict was not unanimous. And of course, to impose the death penalty in North Carolina, there has to be a unanimous verdict. There was a huge sigh of relief from our side of the table. As it turned out, the jury voted 10-2 in favor of death. That's known as staring at the hangman and being able to walk away.
Ended up with a life sentence.
That is correct.
You're probably best known for your remarks at the first appearance of Lawrence Lovett, charged in the deaths of Eve Carson and Abhijit Mahato.
Right.
You write at length about this incident in Blind Justice. The media coverage of the event, of course, immense. You had been warned not to say anything controversial, but you took that moment in his first appearance to talk about gang legislation, anti-gang legislation. Why?
Well, at the time, around March 1st of 2008, because of the fact I had missed so much work as a result of my illness, I had already decided to resign. I hadn't told anybody, but I already made that decision. When the Lawrence Lovett case came in front of me, to understand why I said what I said, you need to understand my background. I was co-chair of the Gang and Truancy Prevention Committee in Durham from 1998 to 2003. I was very familiar with the anti-gang legislation. In fact, had done a national search of gang legislation throughout the country. I was very frustrated that the anti-gang legislation had sat in the State House for more than 6.5 years without action. Meanwhile, just like many members of the public in the media, we were seeing more and more evidence of gang activity and gang violence in the state. Something simply needed to be done. You can call it a fastball across the plate that I hit because I thought it was an appropriate time to do so, because I believed in what I said, and ultimately it resulted in new anti-gang legislation that passed about 2 months later.
But you had to know that saying what you said when you said it could very likely prejudice a case of someone facing what would be a capital murder trial charge who had not been accused of gang activity.
Well, I understand that. Of course, it was not a crime that he was charged with because the law did not exist at that time. The other thing, too, simply, is that I had not realized, since I'm blind, that he had not been removed from the courtroom.
Oh, yeah, and the context. I mean, it was right.
And I regret that in terms of any possible prejudice to him. I frankly want to limit my comments regarding either Lawrence Lovett or Mr. Atwater at this time, because Mr. Atwater is facing sentencing and Mr. Lovett will go on trial for the Eve Carson murder in Orange County in November.
But, I mean, in the context, whether they were in the courtroom or not, this was on the heels of their first appearance.
Well, it was. There's no question.
Should you have done it? Do you think now you should not have
In retrospect, had I not decided to resign from the bench previously, no.
What does your resignation have to do with your decision to make that comment at that time?
Well, at that point, I had nothing. In a way, I had nothing to fear, and I could speak my mind. A judge has to be careful in terms of what you say publicly when you're on the bench. The reason I crossed that line was out of frustration, number one. I saw an opportunity to push the legislation forward, number two, and I wanted to help us all better protect the people of North Carolina, given the scourge of gang activity in the state.
We also, earlier in your career, you received a judicial censure, and that was for your participation regarding the disposition of a couple of DWI cases in 1998.
Right.
Tell us about that, how that came about, and why it happened.
Well, back at that time, things were less strict in terms of driving while impaired offenses than they are today. I simply trusted too much in terms of what I was told, because most of my experience in recent years before I became a district court judge had been in superior court rather than district court. I was not as familiar as I should have been regarding the Safe Roads Act. I deeply regret what happened, Frank. I'm very sorry for it. But because Dr. Podger, the defendant in that case, is deceased, and his attorney, Wes Covington, is also deceased, I don't think it's fair for me to say anything more than that.
But attorneys came to you and changed the charge, essentially, outside of the courtroom. So it was sort of an in-the-hallway kind of a transaction.
Well, at that time, it was not illegal to do it outside the courtroom. But nevertheless, I should have followed procedure, and that was one of the reasons, I think, that it happened like it did.
Is there too close a relationship between the judges, the attorneys, they see each other, and the DA? When these deals get made, you say now the law has changed, it's a little more strict. Is it strict enough? I mean, can we trust that this system is really being carried out fairly and transparently, or do you think still too much happens out of our sight?
Well, I think it's much better than it was before. The legislature made it very clear after the Podger case that all pleas and sentences had to be imposed in open court. So that became very clear as a result of that. There were other changes that were made as well. I do think that, obviously, given that 95% of criminal and traffic cases are resolved by plea, the pleas do not involve the judge. They involve the district attorney and the defense attorney, and those typically occur in a conference room. But ultimately, it's up to the judge as to whether or not they accept or reject the plea. What I look for as a presiding judge was whether or not the plea that came before me was consistent with other pleas on a similar charge that I had heard earlier.
On the state of things today, my guest this hour, retired Durham District Judge Craig Brown. And when we come back, we'll consider some of the social forces that shape the judicial system from the outside. Stay with us on the state of things. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, retired District Court Judge Craig Brown, spent 3 decades as a defense attorney and later as a judge in Durham. You know, you talked about the 2 capital cases you tried with mitigating circumstances, substance abuse, mental instability, the fact that in one case the offender expressed remorse. And I want to talk about the way the justice system works from what you've seen in the inside, maybe the need for the Racial Justice Act. I'm thinking of the case of Eddie Hartman. Eddie Hartman executed in 2003.
Right.
He was someone who was an alcoholic, a chronic alcoholic who had been abused as a child. All of these were considered the kind of mitigating circumstances that would transfer your sentence from death to life. And yet it didn't work. And in that case, both his attorneys and a number of social justice groups will say the fact that his sexuality, that he was gay, mm-hmm. was raised over and over again mm-hmm. by the district attorney was the difference. He was executed with all those mitigating circumstances.
Right.
So this gets us to whether or not justice is truly applied fairly or whether these factors whether you're gay or African American or a person of color in this system, do you get a fair shake?
Well, you get a much more fair shake than you used to, certainly 50 years ago. Every defendant has the right to counsel. Now, granted, with public defender's offices, those attorneys are so overworked that it may be difficult sometimes for them to give full attention to one case or another, but they do the very best they can. In terms of the racial question, I think it's fairer than it used to be, but I don't think it's perfect by any stretch.
What do you think of the Racial Justice Act that allows us to review capital cases, capital sentences?
I think it is very important before you commit the ultimate sanction of taking someone's life on behalf of the state to have every aspect of injustice, especially racial injustice, fully exposed to determine whether or not that is appropriately found in a given case. I think it's very important that the moratorium we've had on the death penalty in the state has been very important, that the Racial Justice Act will lead to a more fair execution of defendants such that is considered to be appropriate, and of course I do not find that to be so.
Can that happen, do you think, with the death penalty? Can it ever be fairly applied?
I think it's very difficult simply because there are so many different factors that go into any death penalty case. I mean, for example, it's been proven statistically that an African-American defendant who kills a white victim is more likely to receive the death penalty, that a white defendant who murders a black victim is less likely to receive the death penalty. So despite the progress that we've made, and it has been considerable, Frank, there are still disparities between the way minorities are treated in the criminal justice system.
Your involvement with the Elric Vaughters case prompted your interest in Durham's TROSA program. It's Triangle Residential Options for Substance Abusers. Tell us about that program, first of all, and then how you became involved.
Well, Riley Butler, who was the former executive director of Sentencing Services before our General Assembly killed it this past session, had talked to me about TROSA, getting involved with the then TROSA idea maybe 6 months before the Vaughters trial. After the Vaughters case, when it became quite apparent to me that there was absolutely no long-term treatment available to the poor and disadvantaged, in terms of drug or alcohol treatment, I felt I had no choice but to join the effort. I went to my first meeting the month after the trial concluded. At the second meeting, they made me chairman, and I was chair of the board for the first 4 years of the TROSA program.
Tell us how TROSA works.
TROSA is a long-term, two-year drug and alcohol rehabilitation program It involves work, the development of a work ethic for all offenders. They're required to learn at least three jobs within the program. They're required to obtain their GED, and they're required to, of course, go through extensive substance abuse treatment during the 2 years that they're in the program. The program has, if you exclude offenders for the first 30 days, about a 40% success rate. TROSA, amazingly, has grown to over 350 residents with a budget of about $10 million. Kevin McDonald, his staff, and the residents are primarily responsible for the TROSA program and its success over the years, and I credit them with that and thank them.
Is there a close enough link and enough interplay between the criminal justice system and programs like and rehabilitation programs that have clear links and education programs, all of the things that ultimately make our society safer, those kind of programs seem somehow disconnected from the criminal justice system, which appears to be devoted to locking them up and putting them away. Should there be a better connection?
Yes. I mean, as I said when I ran for judge in 1996, it's still true today. Justice does not begin at the courthouse steps, and it does not end there either. There needs to be a stronger interplay between preventive programs on the front end and upon rehabilitative programs at the back end.
What's in the way of that?
Lack of resources. The focus of the legislature this past session was to focus simply on the court system and not any of the ancillary programs on either end. I think in the long run that's a mistake, and I believe that ultimately what will happen will be a higher rate of crime as a result of that.
Well, yeah, you spent a lot of money on jails, so you took that some of that money and put it into prevention.
That's correct.
There'd be plenty of resources available. So what about the system itself? We have seen Mike Nifong, who you mentioned was an assistant district attorney for much of your career. He
right.
became an infamous district attorney.
Right.
Tracy Klein now facing charges, at least in the press, of doing much of the same thing, of withholding evidence, of not sending evidence, allegedly not sending evidence to be processed in time for the defendant to defend himself. You yourself took on a case, and this was, I guess, the public defender's fault, for never having looked at the evidence in a case. Isn't that right?
Right.
Before, and it didn't go to trial. It just got delayed. But had it gone to trial, that client would have been convicted.
Yeah.
Is there something wrong with the system? Are the incentives in the wrong place? Because I'm guessing this doesn't just happen in Durham.
No, I don't think it just happens in Durham. I think Durham is often highlighted in the press because of our unfortunate reputation, which I believe is not deserved. In terms of the Tracy Klein matter, I really can't comment too much on that because I've only had one of the three articles read to me. But I think you have to look at her record in context. I've known her for many years. I never had the problem that is described in the articles with her as a defense lawyer or as a district court judge. So I think you have to be very careful when you look at allegations that are made because they're simply allegations. Certainly you can recall the many allegations that were made against Governor Easley after he left office and how many of them were actually proven.
There do seem to be incentives, though. The incentives are placed now for just getting the conviction. We've seen a number of cases of wrongful conviction, and they're the high-profile cases. We're only looking at death penalty. We don't know how many Class D felonies that put people away for 40 years got done because it was easy enough to do. The incentive, it seems to me, is for a conviction and not necessarily for justice. If you're a police officer and you're doing your job, you get graded on how many arrests you make and not how you make the streets safe, because we haven't figured out a way to grade our police officers or our district attorney on that.
Well, I agree with you to some point, and I disagree with you in others. I think that any member of the legal system, whether they're an attorney, a judge, a district attorney, a defense attorney, has their reputation. And believe me, all sides know what that reputation is. So if you have a defense attorney who likes to cut it close to the line, the state usually knows that. If you've got a member of the district attorney's office who does the same thing on their end, believe me, the defense bar knows that. None of this information is in the dark. Every police officer has a reputation for veracity or lack thereof. And believe me, it's taken into account by the defense lawyer, by the prosecuting attorney, and judges also know them too because, of course, we talk about lawyers in our judges' meetings simply because we want to protect other judges from any problems that might occur.
I have to say, in the number of cases that have come to light about misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, just the opposite was taking place. Once it was well known that this is going on, everybody on the inside circled the wagons to protect their office from the stain of this scandal.
Sure.
And it became hard, particularly in a capital case, how can we admit that we railroaded a guy who was going to lose their life, or that once we found the guy who might have done it, we can't possibly bring up the exculpatory evidence because we were about to put a guy to death. And so it becomes even more imperative that you hide the truth and circle around your good friend.
Well, That may be an approach that some people take and that works temporarily. But ultimately what I have found over the course of my career is that the truth comes out over time and that the system works well to correct itself where there are problems. It's not perfect by any stretch, Frank. It's a human system based upon the frailties that all humans have. But in the scheme of things, I believe we have a system that works well, given all the demands that are placed upon it.
Tell us about what it was like for you as 11 years as a judge and also before that as a defense attorney, working with Behçet's disease and with your blindness.
Well, it meant I had to do things differently. One of the things that I did before I ran for judge is that I spent several days sitting in all the various courtrooms, simply observing what was going on, or at least rather, I guess, being present in the courtroom, to see whether I felt that it was possible for a blind person to be in the role of a judge. Governor Hunt asked me that when we had our conversation prior to the appointment, and my answer was yes. I simply had to do it differently. It is true that when you go blind, your other systems rewire. My hearing is somewhat like radar. On a good day, I could hear the witness breathing on the stand. You learn to listen to the tone, the pace, the description of the facts from that witness's point of view versus what you would think if I were in the same situation, whether or not the story fits so perfectly that it may be untrue, because I've also always found that the truth is usually a bit messy. Ultimately, I would like to think that with the accommodations that I made, that the various attorneys made, that the system did work well.
Why did you decide to resign?
I decided to resign because Behçet syndrome, as I said earlier, attacks small blood vessels. In 2001, I had my first attack on my brain. In 2006, I had a major attack. In 2009, I had a third attack. I felt simply that there was one of the triggers of my illness has always been stress. And the job of being a judge, whatever you may think of it, is extremely stressful. And I simply felt that it was in my best interest to retire from the bench because of that. And also because I had missed so much time from work. And my brethren were required to pick up what I was unable to do, and that wasn't fair to them.
How much has the treatment advanced in Behçet's just in your lifetime?
next to nothing. More is known about it. The chemotherapy that I'm on now seems to hold it in abeyance, but I also know from 35 years of experience with the disease that nothing stops it. That when it attacks a system, it usually continues to attack, regardless of whatever treatment is imposed. At this point, I would describe my health as stable but guarded.
And you said that originally you were given a prognosis of 2 years.
That's correct.
Vision, and it was extended to 16 years. How did that happen?
Well, my doctors decided that at that point, the only drug of real treatment then was prednisone, steroids. I fortunately did not have a bad reaction to a large dose of steroids. For a period of about 12 years, I probably took an average of 80 to 100 milligrams of prednisone a day, which puts you up in the several hundred thousand milligrams of prednisone over my lifetime. That worked to slow the disease down, for which I credit my doctors, because it gave me time to hit the top of the experience curve, which is the only thing that made it possible for me to become a judge.
You miss being on the bench?
I do.
How do you view the system now as an outsider? Can you see it as an outsider yet?
I can. You know, I miss it on the one hand. On the other hand, I don't miss the stress and the difficulty of the decisions that a judge is required to make. Looking at it from the outside is very different. One of the things that I regret is that sometimes the media, in a 15 or 30 second spot, does not capture the case well. It happens sometimes. One example I would give of that would be with respect to the custody case that was heard by Nancy Gordon here in Durham with the mother who had breast cancer. When I first heard the story in the press, my reaction was either Judge Gordon had gone crazy, which I rather doubt, or there was something I didn't know. Channel 8 out of Winston-Salem has an hour devoted to local news, and their story was entitled, "Maybe the Judge Got It Right." It was a three-minute segment that it turned out that Judge Gordon had appointed an expert, and the expert had recommended that it was in the best interest of the children, in light of their mother's illness, to go to with their father. Certainly, I wish both the mother and father well, but that just gives some idea of, with a short period of time, what the media can miss in terms of a court case.
Judge Brown, thanks so much for being on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Retired District Court Judge Craig Brown has chronicled his life and career in a pair of books, Blind Justice and A Fork in the Road. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.